Go to everydaynovelist.com/support to join the madness.
Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of nearly 30 books, more than 30 short stories, and numerous articles and scripts and essays, coming to you from up in the crow's nest with my spyglass on this daily voyage through the dicey waters of business, craft, learning, and art in the writing life.
Welcome to The Questions, Episode 710. Today, Terry asks...
In movies and television, the musical score provides subliminal cues telling the viewer how to feel. Changing the soundtrack can change a horror movie into a comedy. Is there a way to create this kind of subliminal cues when writing?
Before the Vikings came to England, language, written language, had no punctuation. It, in fact, didn't even have spaces between the words. You can still see this if you read Hebrew. The Hebrew Bible, if you get it in its proper form, doesn't have any punctuation. It doesn't even have any vowels, frankly. But it doesn't have any separation between the words or punctuation or line breaks or anything like that. And the reason for this is that language has its own inherent rhythms. And people were expected to be able to intuit the proper rhythm of speech, the proper emphasis and everything, based on the rhythm of the words chosen and the meaning of the words chosen, and their context within a sentence. It was deep structure without any scaffolding. All of those tricks, all of those deep structure things, are still there in language. We've just dumbed it down quite a lot, and in doing so, we've added a number of extra, very useful tools in the written language to encapsulate the subtleties of the spoken language. Because when you speak, a lot of the information, the bulk of the information, is not coming from the words you're using. It's coming from the tone and the pacing and the rhythm and, of course, the visual cues if you're in person. Visual body language conveys a huge amount, from microfacial expressions to gestures of the hands to posture to breathing rhythm to all that kind of stuff. Some of it you can hear, because facial expressions change the shape of the face, which change the shape of the mouth, which changes the sound of the words. Breathing, of course, you can hear in the rhythm of breathing as you talk, and you can make something go pretty breathless and you can make something go pretty breathless and go on and on and on and on and on and on and on until someone's waiting and wondering when you're going to stop and pause and take a breath, like I just did. So all these things are available to you, but you don't know they're there. Most people don't know they're there. Poets know they're there, especially people who write real poetry and not free verse. And what's interesting is that free verse and modernist poetry keeps sliding back into a lot of the deep structure stuff by accident. So, to back up, poetry evolved in the English language tradition. Poetry evolved a number of distinct forms: the sonnet, the couplet, the limerick. Everyone knows a limerick. There once was a lady from Venus whose body was shaped like a Mr. Data. They're usually dirty, and they're very, very catchy. Particular poetic structures have, a haiku in Japanese, a prescribed number of lines, a prescribed number of syllables per each line, a prescribed rhythm of beats in each line between the syllables, and a prescribed rhyme structure and expected ending type and all of that. It's very rigid forms. Because of this, once the forms were well explored by about the 17th or 18th centuries, poets started to feel a little constrained. And all the best sonnets have been done. All the best limericks have been done. Or at least, if there are any more to do, they're really hard to find because the geniuses that came before us have picked all the low-hanging fruit, and what the hell are we going to do? Because we're never going to build a reputation greater than that of the early geniuses, even if what we do is harder and what we do is better because they defined the form, and we're just sort of filling up the corners of the space they created. So there were a lot of innovations starting in the 18th century, a lot of innovations in poetic form, and something that came to prominence in the late 19th century was the prose poem, where the structure, the visual structure of lines and couplets and whatnot was completely abandoned for just writing blocks of text. The trick being that the blocks of text were written and meant to be spoken aloud as if they were poetry. I dreamed of Orkhil, the dim goddess who sits beneath the earth in a vast cavern and weaves at two looms. I wish I remembered the whole thing. The poem of Orkhil, we'll link to it in the show notes, is a fantastic, genre-defining prose poem, deeply poetic, while attempting to appear to simply be prose. In the early 20th century, a lot of fiction writers picked up on this. This is what kick-started the genre of literary fiction, was the incorporation of poetic techniques into prose. You can see this very, very distinctly in the writings of Virginia Woolf and of J.R.R. Tolkien, especially in The Silmarillion, which was published after his death. The Silmarillion is unreadable unless you read it out loud. And then it bursts forth in this amazing richness, this sensual buffet, an intellectual feast that is very, very dense and kind of inaccessible when you read it on the page. But the moment it finds a voice, it's like sheet music. If you're a really good musician or a really good composer, you can read sheet music and hear the music as written in your head, but it still pales in comparison to having a maestro play it. The Silmarillion is the same. The writings of Virginia Woolf are the same, even though I absolutely hate her books. The writings of George Eliot are like this. And though I hate her books, Toni Morrison's work is like this. The reason Toni Morrison has the cachet she does is not just that she was a black writer writing about black experience and coming to the fore in the late 60s and early 70s. It's because she has this deeply poetic writing style that establishes a wonderful dreamlike experience for the reader. If you read a book for the kinds of things I read books for, that's really annoying, because though the style is beautiful, I hate the way she tells a story. Absolutely hate it. But the style is gorgeous, and it's because it's poetry. It's not prose. It pretends to be prose. During this same time, the desire to break free from all constraints. Now, we're moving up, I guess, to the early 20th century, after the occultists. Actually, the occultists kind of started it. William Blake and T.S. Eliot and Samuel Taylor Coleridge and that whole cohort, the members of the Order of the Golden Dawn, they started doing freer form poetry. It was still structured. It still had a rhythm, but it played very fast and loose, like jazz does. Very fast and loose. And out of that came the free verse poetry movement, where basically you write a bunch of short declaratives in a row that doesn't have any structure, anything really linking it, and you call it a poem. And sometimes free verse is tremendous. Most of the time, it sucks. Because in order to make it tremendous, what you actually have to do is employ deep structural methods while eschewing the structural methods that will be obvious to the eye. And, of course, out of free verse grew the beats and slam poetry and all these other allegedly structureless, breaking free from structure poetical forms. But they all keep rediscovering the same deep structures of language. You can even see it in the way stand-up comedians work. Really good stand-up comedians have mastered the art of deep linguistic structure. as have really good political speechwriters throughout history, not just speeches that are going on right now. In fact, the art of political rhetoric has taken a serious nosedive in the last 20 or 30 years. I think Bill Clinton was probably the last really great speaker, really great orator that Americans had as a president. And probably Margaret Thatcher was the last great orator that the Brits had. Though, Blair was okay. Blair wasn't great, though, as an orator. And, of course, the great orators of the early 20th century are all notorious, no matter which side they were on. But they're all dealing from the same deck of cards. It's all the same deep linguistic structures going on. Now, if you want to learn these, there's two ways, and I actually recommend using both. Because you will pick stuff up in one direction, in one way that you won't pick up the other way, and vice versa. So, the first way is the fire hose method. Start listening, not reading, listening to political speeches, poetry performed aloud, really good stuff. By really good stuff, I mean stuff that really grabs your attention. I don't mean stuff that I particularly think is good. I mean the stuff that grabs you and you don't know why, whatever that is. Patter, rap, these are all different kinds of spoken word art form. Get to love the spoken word. And audiobooks by writers who wrote with good, deep, structural, stylistic cues. Morrison, if you can stand her. Poe, Wolfe, Tolkien, Lewis, George MacDonald, John D. MacDonald, for that matter, Raymond Chandler, all just amazing at using the deep structure of language to reveal far more than the words do. Quentin Tarantino calls it the poetry between the lines. Tarantino's dialogue is another great example of this kind of writing, as is Kevin Smith's dialogue, especially in his earlier, more dialogue-driven films. Then, while you're doing that, also reapproach the classics. Shakespeare, Homer, the more literary parts of the Bible, especially the King James Version, because that preserves, one of the goals of the King James Version was to preserve the poetic cadence of the original Hebrew and marry it to the Shakespearean cadence, which is why it has that recitable quality to it. And any poets that strike your fancy, especially poets writing before about 1950, because that's when the whole post-structural thing came in and things went mushy for a while. And as you're doing that, study formally, study the structure and technique of poetry. The discipline is called scansion, S-C-A-N-S-C-I-O-N. It's how a poem scans. There's a way you can actually mark up a poem so that you can read it like you're reading sheet music. And once you learn to scan a poem, mark it up, you then will acquire the ability, with a little bit of practice, not a lot of practice, just a little bit, you'll acquire the ability to look at a block of text, raw text, maybe even undifferentiated text, and hear the music that makes up the language. When you have the music that makes up the language, and you do these both things, you're acquiring it formally and you're training yourself to recognize it, and you're acquiring it subconsciously by saturating yourself with great examples of what's been done. When you have both of these things, you got the music that undergirds language, you will be able to use all, I mean, you might take a little practice again, but you will notice that the subconscious cues that don't have anything to do with the words themselves, that create that subliminal music that directs your readers how to feel, is seeping through into your writing. Some writers that were masters of this in recent history, P.G. Wodehouse, Douglas Adams, the Brits are great at this because they have such a fantastic theater tradition, frankly. In the U.S., Dorothy Parker and Flannery O'Connor were amazing with this. And Stephen R. Donaldson, also shockingly good. These are the kinds of people whose work is infused with music. So, check them out. Learn the tricks, and it can be applied, like mentioning people like Poe and Chandler, it can be applied to any genre. All you gotta do is hear the music. Thank you very much for sending it in, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written by J. Daniel Sawyer and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and Kitty Nakian, and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions Incorporated. The text is copyright 2019 J. Daniel Sawyer and the under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license, and all other rights are reserved to their respective owners. Join the conversation. Submit a question, leave a comment, or a creative death threat. Or find me at jdsawyeronminds.com or hit me at feedback@jdsawyer.net. We can't do it without you.